Welcome to ATS Mix.
And I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
But also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
The Internet's most popular conspiracy theory discussion board. ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
Well, John, this is going to be really a special show because it's not our normal show, is it?
Yeah, absolutely not.
And would you like telling the members why it's going to be a special show?
No.
Okay, I will.
All right.
It is because we don't have the UFOologists around the world telling us their sightings,
yes.
Number one. Number two, we do not have the Skeptinator.
Yes.
Okay. But number three, we do have a guest, and his name is Jay Kopelman, and he is a lieutenant colonel, ex-lieutenant colonel in the Marines, and he wrote a couple of books, and we're going to be discussing his latest book, which has to do with a dog named Lava that they fell in love with over in Iraq, and through a lot of red tape and some minor miracles along the way, bring Lava back. But before we get into that, John,
yes,
we are on the eve of you leaving, going to Washington. So
yes.
tell everybody why you're going to Washington.
Well, we have a gentleman that we've interviewed in the past by the name of James Gilliland, and most of our members and listeners alike that have listened to our show know that the last time that we interviewed him, he had invited us to come up to his Satfa Sanctuary, just outside of Mount Adams in Washington. There's been a number of UFO sightings. There's been a number of orb sightings. There have been people that claim that their lives are completely changed after being there. Apparently, where his ranch is at, there are vortex lines and ley lines that intersect there, and people get energized and have life-changing events that happen when they visit. So I asked the owners of ATS if they would mind since I had a little time coming up here, vacation time for my work, if I could go up there and do a little bit of an investigation in the hopes of being able to uncover something fantastic for our members and listeners alike. They granted me the chance to go up there, and then we found out that they were going to join us. At least a couple of them were going to come up and join us up there at Gilliland's ranch. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And we can't really tell you a lot about that. But
top
when
secret.
That's right. But
that's
when,
why we're called Above Top Secret.
But bump.
It's top secret, John.
That's right.
You're the only disclosure we can make, except for it's been newly posted that the Springinator is going to be joining you. But
that is correct.
We can't disclose anything else.
That's right.
Sworn to secrecy.
That's right.
Sworn to secrecy. All right. Well, you're going up there for the secret rendezvous with Springer and some unknown people. And what do you hope to find, John?
Well, I'm hoping to find anything but planes and satellites. That would be nice.
Well, I saw the pictures that you posted at AboveTopSecret.com
and
some of your equipment. Now, you know, you and I have talked. We've been friends for over a year now. But, you know, I know that you've got all kinds of bells and whistles and toys and stuff that you do when you go out and do your 25-year quest to find, you know, get your own answers, if you will, as an independent analyst or whatever.
Okay.
But, boy, that photograph, John, of your cameras was just amazing.
That's really only a third of my collection.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, but it blows me away that you've got that much invested. I mean, even visualizing the whole scenario. In cameras, God, John, I mean, unbelievable.
Well,
you got insurance policies.
Yes, they are insured. The one thing that any ufologist or researcher or sky watcher knows or should know is the fact that if you have a sighting, it will become more credible if you have, one, more witnesses, two, more cameras documenting it, and three, it is witnessed and or documented by someone else in a different part of the town, location, or maybe even state you know, depending on the sighting itself.
Isn't that called triangulation?
The more people you have, the better chance you have of triangulating what the sighting is. You can figure out distance, speed. In some cases, you might even be able to guesstimate, for the most part, what size the craft might be and how fast it is going. So, you know, it's the old rule of thumb. The more people you got that see it, the better the chances are that it actually did happen.
So when you guys get back and stuff, and after all the things are put away, you're going to be we're going to be doing some special shows, kind of is a debrief, are we not, about what y'all found or didn't find?
That is correct.
Right. Well, I'm excited about that. But, you know, before we listen to Jay, John, you know, I know we've talked about it just briefly, but I know you spent some time with some of the amazing people that were in the MUFON recent thing about, a week ago from this recording, I guess?
Yeah, up in San Jose.
Why don't you tell everybody just briefly, John, about, you know, how maybe, you know, let me do it this way. What was the most interesting guest, I guess, that they had there? And I know they had a buttload, but what was the most interesting guest or pair of guests that they had there that seemed to get the most wow factor from all those hundreds of people that attended it, John?
Okay, well, that's kind of a hard one, but let me just briefly tell you a few speakers and guests that were there that blew me away, and then I'll answer your query.
Okay.
We got to hear George Knapp, Colm Kelleher, who you and I both interviewed,
right.
And they talked about the hunt for the Skinwalker Ranch. I got to listen to Pat Uskart, who is the star of the TV show UFO Hunters on the Discovery Channel and History Channel. Got to hear Dr. Richard Haynes and Ted Rowe, who are in charge of NARCAP. I got to hear Dr. Anthony Choi from Machu Picchu, Peru, who had some fantastic UFO footage. Victor Camacho, who is also one of our Latin UFO sightings reporters here at ATS, and he had some footage. You talk about wow factor. He had some footage there of something strange that was about 3 or 4 feet tall, caught on two separate cameras. That's just incredible, and I'm hoping that eventually that's going to get released. In fact, somebody told me that there's already a link on YouTube to it, and so we have posted that link at the bottom of a page I created called My MUFON Symposium Experience.
And that's what a great thread that is, John. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but boy, you posted some neat photographs.
Well, hang on. I haven't answered your question yet. I haven't answered your question.
Are you going to answer it?
Yes, I am. I'm going to get right to it. And then I got a surprise for you.
I love surprises. What?
So a number of different guest speakers there that totally blew me away. But my all-time favorite was the last speaker we had at the Field Investigators Training Seminar, which was on the very first day. It was a private function on Thursday, not open to the public. And our last speaker on that day was abduction expert Bud Hopkins. And
I love that guy.
He just totally blew me away. In fact, would you like to listen to, I'm not going to play the whole thing, but there's a little excerpt that I recorded that I would love to play for you and the listeners.
Oh, I'd love to hear it.
All right, here it is.
As most of you, I'm sure, know, if a person has had a lot of lifetime experiences, or quite a number, that person probably has been able to successfully bury most of them and say, well, it was this, it was that. But there's always the one thing that's the triggering recollection. That person will begin telling you about that particular central thing. But one of the things you want to ask at some point along the way is, well, how about your childhood? Did you have a happy childhood? Did you have friends at school that you still see? Did you ever have bad dreams? Everybody has bad dreams. You know, you kind of connect yourself with the issues that you're asking that person to come up with. And you can find out many interesting things from people by going back to childhood when the person maybe isn't even conscious that they have had childhood experiences. I'll give you one example, which is quite amazing to me. A man had come to me about some recent experiences. He was in his early 40s. When I asked him about the childhood, any unusual childhood experiences, he said, no, nothing. I said, Well, you know, we have lost sometimes. Many of us have gotten lost. I got lost once, that kind of thing. And he said, well, I got lost once, but it wasn't a mystery. And I said, well, tell me about it. He said, oh, I was about six. And I was out playing, and suddenly was in a neighborhood I didn't recognize. And I was lost. And I said, oh, that must have been very upsetting. And the little boy, 6 years old, he said, no, no, I wasn't upset. It just seemed okay. And these two policemen came over, and they took me home. And I said, gee, that's great. I said, did you go up and knock on a door or something and let people in that strange neighborhood know that you were lost? Did they call the police? He said, no, no, they just kind of showed up. And I'm thinking, you know, nothing is quite making total sense here. So I said, well, I imagine, you know, you always hear these stories, did the policemen let you wear their hats and they bought you an ice cream cone? That's what's supposed to happen in the movies. No, no, they didn't. They just put me in the car and took me home. And I said, well, were you old enough at six to know your home address? And he said, well, I guess I was, because they knew where I lived. And I said, well, I imagine when you got home, your parents probably missed you, a little six-year-old, and they must have been very, very grateful to those policemen when they brought you in. He said, oh, they didn't bring me in. They just kind of left me there in front of the house. I said, you mean they didn't make sure that it was really your house, the six-year-old? No, they just seemed, you know, and I'm thinking, this isn't really making much sense. I said, because this man was still in touch with his father, he was very elderly. I said, ask your dad and mom about that. I'm sure that's probably somebody who's been much talked about in the family at the time you got lost and the policeman brought you back. He called me the next day and said, they don't remember it. They don't remember it at all. The only conscious memory he had was when he got in the police car. The policemen were just sitting there and... But there was a hole in the floor of the police car. And I said, gee, that must have been a pretty broken down police department to have a hole in the... He said, yeah, I guess it was. And I said, did these, you know, cops usually take their hats off when they're in the car. Did they have their hats on or off? He said, no, they had them off. And I said, it was like one blonde guy and a dark haired guy. Because you always ask literal, realistic questions away from the UFO subject. Oh, no, he said, they didn't have any hair, either one of them. And when we did hypnosis on this incident, and these policemen who couldn't speak to him, who were not in uniform exactly, took him into this round police car, and he was remembering this as a six-year-old, he was, I said, you had said there was a hole in the floor. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, I imagine, you know, in the police car, you could look down and through the hole and you could see, like, dead leaves on the sidewalk or on the street or old crushed beer cans. And I said, take a look. He said, I'm seeing the tops of trees. Well, the point about all this is that he had not thought there was anything unusual about this. And it's only by asking one question after another, but always in terms of the situation of this still being a normal thing. A little boy is lost and he's with two policemen.
Wow, John. You know, I am so envious of you. I mean, you not only did you get to hear Bud, but I mean, you got to, you know, I mean, Colm and George and the other ones that you've mentioned that I have heard their names. Heard you mention their names, you know, over the last year. God, I am so jealous, John. I so wanted to do that with you, and it just really disappointed. Maybe I can do it next year with you. What do you think?
Yeah, well, don't forget that coming up here in September, we're all still planning on coming to San Jose more time to the Bay Area UFO Expo at the Marriott's Hotel.
Well, listen, I want you to do me a favor when you go up to Washington.
Yeah.
You know, and you go up to James Gillian's ranch. I understand he has a gift shop now. Could you?
How do I know this is going to go south? Go ahead.
Could you bring me back a shirt that says Johnny went to James Gillian's ranch, but all I got was this lousy T-shirt?
Well, okay. You know what? I actually thought you were going to go somewhere else with that, and I thought it would have some reference to Bush beans and a campfire and Blazing Saddle movies. Thank you for not going there.
No, I posted that on the thread.
Oh, okay.
Well, actually, some of the members jumped in and said they wanted to see that also, you know.
Yeah, it ain't going to happen, people. Sorry. It ain't going to happen.
I didn't figure it would. But seriously, can you, you know, Gillian's got one of those gift shop things. Can you bring me back like a T-shirt or something?
If he has a gift shop, Dave, I'll bring you back a damn T-shirt, all right?
Okay. I'd like to get some out of it. Because, you know, damn, all these neat trips you get to go on, and I'm stuck down here in Corpus Christi. Just really chaps my ass, man.
Yeah. Well, listen, we don't. Speaking of chapping asses, we don't want to chap our listeners and members' asses anymore. What do you say we get to the show?
I'd love to listen to this show. It's a good one. I think everybody's going to really enjoy this guy.
ATS Mix featured interview.
Our guest that we're going to be interviewing today is also a military man like yourself. Well, maybe not exactly like yourself, but, you know, that
there's
that
no
might be,
military man
that's
like myself.
Right. That might be stretching it a bit. But anyway, let's tell everybody who we have on today. Let me read a little bit about his bio. It's very interesting. This is a great guest we've got on here for today. During his last tour of duty in Iraq, international best-selling author Lieutenant Colonel Jay Kopelman of the U.S. Marines adopted an abandoned puppy left behind during the battle for Fallujah. Upon his return to the U.S., he recounted his remarkable story to the New York Times, the Times of London, Australian and Brazilian bestseller memoir that he wrote, which was called From Baghdad with Love, A Marine, The War, and a Dog Named Lava. With both a tender and yet thought-provoking perspective, he found hope in the grim realities of wartime Iraq. When Kopelman returned from Iraq, he was asked to help train the Marines who would return back to Iraq as advisors to the Iraqi armed forces and the police. His last assignment was as the Deputy Assistant Chief of Staff for Advisor Training for the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force. Speaking to audiences about his experiences in Iraq while sharing his story of lava, he also addresses his journey of leadership and his perspectives on current world events, terrorism, and how politics will affect Iraq and the world. He does this in Lava's name recognition to various domestic and international animal rescue organizations to help raise awareness and money for abandoned and assistance animals. The Helen Woodward Animal Center, the Canine Companions for Independence, Dutch Puppy, and the Humane Society International. He has also recently served on the board of directors of the Enduring Freedom Killed in Action Fund and donates a portion of his book's earnings to the Freedom Is Not Free Fund, which is based in San Diego. His book, From Baghdad with Love, A Marine, The War, and A Dog Named Lava, is available at fine bookstores everywhere and also Amazon.com. Not that Amazon.com isn't a fine bookstore in itself, but Dave and I are very honored right now to have with us today Jay Kopelman. Say hello to Dave and Johnny, Jay.
Hey, hello, Dave and Johnny. How are you?
I love military men. They really follow instructions.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Jay, I can't tell you what an honor it is to finally talk to you. Of course, we have talked to Jen several times, your publicist on the book and stuff, and she was very gracious enough to send me a copy of From Baghdad to America, which is that the sequel?
Right, that's the follow-up to the first book, and it is a sequel of sorts in that it talks about coming back from Iraq the last time and what life has been for Lava and me since we've returned.
All right. Well, you know, I guess let's kind of get it started. John, I think you've got the first question.
Well, you know, I think I think that probably the most obvious question right in the get-go is, so here you are, a military man. You're fighting for your country. Tell us, how does Lava enter into your life?
He was found by a group of Marines from Hawaii, from 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines, the Lava Dogs, during the Battle of Fallujah in November 2004. And it was very early on in that battle when they heard a noise. One of the senior staff NCOs told one of the junior NCOs to go take care of the dog. They heard this noise coming from a 55-gallon oil drum. And, using all good initiative, the young Marine who went and grabbed Lava took care of him. He They didn't tell him how to. I believe the implied task was kill the damn thing because he's making too much noise. But this Marine didn't do that. He got lava and rescued him, and then the young Marines kept him, and they were taking care of him. When I came into the city with the Iraqis that I was working with during that battle and linked up with the lava dogs.
I don't want to throw a monkey wrench in this, but I did a little bit of investigating. Isn't there a general order called 1A that is pretty much taken seriously by the military that there is no pets allowed? Did you meet any resistance with this regulation?
You know what? They would have put lava down on the base when he finally went to live in Camp Fallujah had the right people or the wrong people found him and got a hold of him. So I didn't meet with any resistance once I got him home. And, you know, there were plenty of jokes even coming from a couple of generals that I worked for after I got him back. And it really wasn't a big deal. It's the order is there for good reason. You know, a dog in combat could be a distraction if it's not trained properly. So, and you can't become attached to an animal like that in the middle of a battle, of a gunfight. You know, I have to worry about the damn animal's safety. You got to worry about your buddies. So there are good reasons for it. Disease is another thing.
Well, you know, my experience with dogs in a combat area, obviously date back to Saigon and my tours in Vietnam. And, of course, we had security police that would patrol the bases, and they had, you know, dogs similar to what you have. And, you know, of course, they were specially trained, you know, for the security of the base. But, you know, I had talked to a few of them, Jay, along the way over my three tours. And I'm telling you, a bond that is with a man is one thing, but a bond that is with a dog is a completely different, if you'll excuse the pun, animal. And I'd really kind of like you to talk a little bit about, you said a young Marine found lava, but how did your personal relationship with the dog develop?
Sure. You know, I first encountered lava following a patrol one day in the house where he was living with these Marines in the city of Fallujah. That was my first encounter with him. And then as time went on and we all spent more time with him, you know, we all grew more attached to lava, of course. And I think that he provided on a daily basis for those of us who saw him, you know, a sense of comfort. It gave everybody an outlet to allow their humanity to surface after daily gunfights. So in that respect, lava certainly provided, you know, comfort and that feeling of home that you don't get any other way. As far as me personally, you know, there were a couple instances where he either where he tried to ingratiate himself to me by crawling into my sleeping bag in the middle of the night and without my knowing it. And then another time I let him, you know, I put him in a box at night and let him sleep in that with one of my fleece tops. So that was really how it began. And what happened is the Marines from Hawaii, these young kids, wanted Lava to go home there. Well, Hawaii has these outrageous quarantine regulations, so I knew that wouldn't happen for them. And I then promised that I would get Lava to the States because I saw how much he meant to them.
Now, this isn't your first time being in battle, right? This was you've served more than one tour, is that correct?
I had two in Iraq.
Right. Well, what was different when you came home this time from the first time? Were you able to make the transition back into civilian life pretty well?
Well, the first time was a pretty short tour. We were only deployed for a few months, and I think only about a month was actually in Iraq, so it was a pretty insignificant tour. But this time coming back was different, I guess, because the length of time there, the different places I was assigned while I was in Iraq, and you know, the different things I had to do this tour. So it was a little different, more combat, and a lot more. The assimilation, I thought, was pretty easy, but then in retrospect and trying to be introspective a little bit, you realize that maybe it wasn't, and maybe I said and did some things I shouldn't have in discussions with people when I got back. You know, I was at a dinner party one night, and these people were all talking about their kids, and I made the comment that fighting terrorists is easier than raising teenagers. And my girlfriend at the time and pretty much everybody else at the table looked at me like I had a male appendage growing out of my head.
Yeah, I'm sure that went over real well, Jay.
Yeah, because, you know, they all had kids, and they all had teenage kids, and I really didn't care about their, you know, their spoiled, rotten children and, you know, the fact that they were ill-mannered.
You know, I'm liking you every minute you talk.
I love this guy.
So, you know, so it was comments like that and my lack of tolerance for their banal BS, and I just couldn't take it. So, you know, as I was writing this book, I realized that I was pretty much a jerk, and there were probably some good reasons for that, and I should explore that a little more.
Well, you know, I guess that kind of leads me up to a minor sidebar, John. I'm going to do a sidebar here. And that is, you know, and I can only relate to this personally, Jay, okay, because, you know, my first tour that I did in Vietnam was in Cameron Bay, which was kind of a no-brainer. It was like the port entry and exit point for, you know, most of the deployment that was done in Southeast Asia. And it really wasn't, you know, a significant thing. We didn't really have a lot of problems to worry about as far as hostile fire and that kind of thing. But my second tour, which was in Phan Rang, we had just a buttload of rocket mortar attacks, and I had friends that were killed. And I was just curious. I always like asking my fellow and female military personnel that have been in Iraq, did you have any experiences with loss of friends?
You know, fortunately, I didn't have any close friends who were killed. I've had friends who were wounded. You know, it was pretty funny. During one firefight, guy to my left and the guy to my right, is like in OCS, they tell you, look to your left, look to your right, because two out of the three of you won't be here after at the end of this thing. And sure enough, two out of the three of us got wounded, and I got hit with shrapnel but didn't get hurt. So
wow.
It was pretty, yeah. But and they were walking wounded, which was fortunate. But you know, fortunately, nobody that I was close to got killed. I've had other buddies shot, and some of the Marines that I was training and we were sending out on these advisor teams came back with some pretty bad wounds. And some of those kids got killed too.
Right.
So I've made a couple trips to Bethesda since I've been back. You know, I try it anytime I'm in the D.C. area. I make it a point to go to the hospital and visit with the Marines and sailors on the fifth floor there. But fortunately, nobody I knew was killed.
Well, that's good. Yeah, that's great. Before we get back to talking a little bit about lava, I'll jump into a question that also Dave likes to ask, and I'm going to steal it from you. Neener, tell us maybe about some of your more, maybe a harrowing experience that you had to go through that you feel that you were pretty lucky to get out alive with.
You know, I think the whole time I was in Fallujah, I was pretty lucky to come out of that city alive because they gave me a Humvee to take around that had no armor.
Oh my!
It was actually one of these four door Humvees, but it was a soft top. It wasn't even a hard top.
Oh my god!
Humvee. So I drove around the city the whole time, you know, dodging rockets and RPGs and machine gun fire in a soft top Humvee. So that was pretty harrowing for me. And I think the scariest part of that whole deal was every time I had to drag an Iraqi soldier or two with me, and they were sitting behind me, and the damn thing, they always had their rifles, their AK-47s, they always had the safety off, and that I was always worried that if we hit a bump, you know, one of these idiots would shoot me in the back
right,
of the head.
Right.
yeah, and that would be the real bummer, you know, you go through the entire tour, and then some knucklehead behind you, you know, has his finger on the trigger, and you hit a rock, and he ends up killing.
I mean, these guys were shooting each other all the time, you know, it wasn't intentional,
right.
But because they had no weapons discipline, they were shooting each other in the legs and in the feet. It was crazy.
Yeah, I've always thought that they should change that term of friendly fire, you know, he was shot by friendly fire to be changed to he was shot by an idiot fire.
Right. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of that. And, you know, they call it, they like to temper it and call it an accidental discharge, but it's really a negligent discharge. And, yeah.
Dave's had a few accidental discharges.
Yeah, but that was downtown Saigon.
But I'm
well. Yeah, right.
But I'm all right. All right, Jay, getting back to lava. You know, obviously, you kind of touched on it a little bit, but I mean, when did you realize that bringing lava back was not going to be as easy as you first hoped for?
Yeah, that had to probably be pretty much of a pain to be able to go through all the red tape to bring back a pet.
Right. Well, you try to circumvent the red tape, but the red tape is very, very long. So I think I realized pretty much immediately that it wasn't going to be simple. I had heard of somebody bringing back a couple dogs, and it sounded like it was relatively easy for them. But then I found out that this person had was in Baghdad in the green zone and had help from somebody with the State Department. So that made it simple. It's really a very difficult process.
Wow.
And in Lava's case, it was a matter of first getting him out of the city of Baghdad, or out of Fallujah, and bringing him to Camp Fallujah. Knowing that I was being reassigned, I had to find somebody to take care of him. So I handed him off to the Marines who were part of our commanding general's personal security detail, and they took care of him for 2 months, and then took him to Baghdad, where he lived for another 2 months with people from NPR in their house in the Red Zone. So once he was there, there was no guarantee of getting him to the U.S. either. We then had to find a means to get him there. And there was one aborted mission to get him to Amman, Jordan, in an SUV. And then he finally was able to catch a flight with a shipment of working dogs from one of the private security contractors and their dog handlers.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a pretty wild trip for him overall. Quite a journey.
Well, he's probably just glad you didn't put on like a little disguise or anything on him.
no disguises.
Yeah.
He was disguised as a well-trained $20,000 Belgian Malinois.
Okay, so in other words, there was no Arnold Schwarzenegger look-alike dog kind of stuff, right?
No, none of that. No stunt doubles.
Oh, thank God.
Well, when you got back to California, Jay, I'm sure things had to be kind of different for you. How did you spend your time once you got back? And if you ever left Lava alone, was he a little paranoid or schizophrenic about being left alone?
Yeah, it was really, it was difficult early on to leave him alone. He was still very much a puppy, and so he wasn't left alone a whole lot. I had dog walkers who would walk him when I was at work, and then I guess it was two summers ago, I ended up just pretty much taking him to work where I was in a building at Camp Pendleton that really we were the only ones in it, so our section. So it was easy to bring him in, and the boss that I had was, he was a great guy. He didn't care, and so if I was somewhere else, the Marines in that building just took care of a lot of it. He hung out with them all day. There were a couple of Marines he didn't like. It was so it made it interesting, but for the most part, it was good for him because he was around people all day, and he didn't have to be left alone. So that worked out all right.
How did you integrate Lava back with your friends and family, and how did they respond to him when they all first met?
Well, there were few friends that Lava doesn't like. I have a few buddies that he just for some reason doesn't like. He will like most people if he doesn't have to meet them for the first time at our house. If you show any fear for dogs around him at all, he's on you. It's like a Doberman. He's just on you. And so from that standpoint, you just have to be careful about who you bring around and when. But otherwise, he's been fine. He likes to intimidate other dogs at the park, that kind of thing.
In other words, is
alpha.
He a bully? Is he a bully?
Yeah, he can be. Yeah, he really can be. So
he sounds a lot like you, Dave.
Well, I was going to say that about you, John.
Well, when they take you to the park, once they let you off your leash. Oh,
yeah, boy. They don't like taking me to the park, though, John.
Hey, Jay, there's a lot of material that you got in your book about being a Marine. And you've also mentioned at one point that Lava makes a pretty good Marine. So explain that. How does he make a good Marine?
Well, he's very loyal, and he never quits. Lava just doesn't know when doesn't know the meaning of the word quit, whatever obstacles are in the way, he figures a way around them and how to get through it.
Well, you know, you give Lava credit for finding your wife at the dog park. Can you describe what you meant by this?
Yeah, I had him at the park one day, as usual, in the evening, and all the dogs were out running around playing there, and there was a young child, a boy of 7 years old, who was new to the area, running around playing with the dogs. So Lava, of course, knew that he had to initiate this new quote-unquote dog to the park and grabbed the boy by the arm and dragged him to the ground. And the boy's mother yelled at me, your dog bit my son, and I was concerned, and I went over and saw her, and I asked, you know, I checked on the boy and made sure he was okay, and then I asked, well, does your son have any diseases I should worry about for my dog? And so 9 months later, she married me.
Hey!
Wow.
That's a story you don't hear every day.
Right.
Well, go ahead, John.
Well, I was going to say that opens up a whole lot of questions there. So I guess you get married, you start a family.
Right.
You've got two books coming on that have been released. How has your feelings now all changed about the war and the military?
I don't know that my feelings have changed at all about any of that. I think I still have the same thoughts about it as I did 5 years ago. My thoughts on it are that we were doing the right, we were headed down the right path in Afghanistan, and that was certainly the right fight to pick, and we should have stuck with that, though, until the end. We didn't see that through, and now we're having to go back and fight that fight again, and you're going to see more and more troops being deployed to Afghanistan, and eventually we'll draw down the size of the force in Iraq, but I don't know where we're going to get the people to continue to fight both fights at the level they need to be fought. So that's going to be a problem. As far as the military, I mean, I will always have undying respect for anybody who serves in uniform. And, you know, for me, it was a great career. I did 21 years, and I don't regret a moment of it. Sometimes it was more wonderful than others, but I can't really remember anything that was particularly bad, and would probably do it all over again if I had the opportunity. You know, if I were young and dumb, and you know what else? Again, I'd go right back and do it. It was a great career. E.B. White said the worst time to become a father is 18 years before a war. But you know, so I, you know, now that I am a father, I guess I have to think about the fact that my son would someday want to join the Marine Corps. And
right.
If he does, all I can do is support him. You know, if that's his decision, then I would certainly support him in that and make sure that he's as prepared as he can be.
Well, you bring up an interesting question, and that is, you made the statement, which, you know, you were talking about Afghanistan and Iraq and, you know, where are we going to get the personnel? And, you know, there's been a huge speculation ever since Vietnam, basically, when they had the draft and then they got rid of the draft and then they decided they're going to do an all-volunteer military. I've kind of noticed, Jay, and I don't know, I guess because of your frequency of being in the military more than me recently, what is the feel amongst the men and women as far as the possibility that in order to do what they're trying to accomplish that they may have to toy with establishing a draft again?
You know, I've not spoken with anybody about that recently, and I guess my thoughts on it are that I would rather have people in combat who really want to be there.
Right.
So, but I guess that's true of any organization. You don't want to have to go out and draft people to come and do what you're doing, you know, people, if they don't want to. My belief, though, is also that I think everybody should have to do some sort of national service in this country, whether it's in the Marine Corps or the Peace Corps. Do something. Serve somewhere. Do your 2 years of service to your country. And, you know, that may compel some people, some more people, to join the military, which would be a good thing because we need the people. But then again, you know, it comes down to money and where do you appropriate that from and who pays for that? Do the taxpayers pay for it? You know, there are many more issues surrounding that whole thing than just saying, yeah, we want more people.
In your book, there seems to be an ongoing theme of mental health that runs through it.
Right.
And I was just kind of curious, relating to not only other Marines and LAVA and the soldiers per se, but also yourself. Was there like a certain point in time that you decided, you know what, I need to look at myself a little differently here and maybe choose a more of an introspective look at yourself?
Yeah, it happened once I started to write this book, the new book, From Baghdad to America, and looking at LAVA and realizing that he had a case of full-blown post-traumatic stress disorder, I realized that I probably should look at myself as well and see if there's anything going on. And what I found is that I really needed to work on some anger issues and lack of tolerance of other people and their opinions and their own little idiosyncrasies. And so in doing so, I realized that I was probably that way before, but the time in combat and my experiences probably just brought, you know, magnified that behavior a little bit, heightened it a little. And I went to talk to somebody about it, and I really hope that veterans who read the book, or their families who read it, or their friends, understand now a little better about what's going on with them, because you can't go to war as if you're at all a thoughtful person and come back unchanged.
Right.
And anybody who says they're completely unchanged and everything's fine who's been in combat is a liar. So,
right.
You know, and the time to get help is not when the symptoms manifest themselves. It's before that, you know, and it's not always easy to recognize that, nor is it always easy to admit it, especially, as you know, Dave, for military people.
Oh, yeah, there's no question about it. In fact, it leads me to a question, Jay, that you kind of touched on. You said you went to Bethesda, or how you pronounce it, the naval installation there, and I'm just curious, you know, I have in Dallas gone to the VA hospital here in Dallas numerous times over the years to see veterans that are there and whatever, and I'm also involved with the welcoming committee that is at DFW International Airport, which this started several years ago when the troops would arrive back home, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A group of us would, you know, welcome them home and that kind of thing. And of course, most of the people that were doing it were like me, were Vietnam veterans who obviously had a different welcoming than you guys. But, you know, the VA hospital thing has come up several times in different questions by the membership at AboveTopSecret.com. And Sanjay Gupta with CNN did an investigative report about the VA and how guys were getting injured over in Iraq, and they were citing several examples, and that the VA was saying, well, you know, the shrapnel wounds were not a combat-oriented thing, and trying to limit, you know, their benefits and stuff. Did you see any of that kind of stuff, you know, when you were going around the hospitals or talking to the troops?
Well, you don't really see that at Bethesda, because Bethesda is where they come as soon as they've been wounded. That's, you know, it's the first hospital they get to in the States before they either go back to their bases or are discharged and then use the VA for their medical care, for all their follow-up. So I haven't really seen a lot of that or any of it, really, except maybe in my own instance. You know, I have a service-connected knee injury, and I filed my VA claim upon retirement for my knee. I've had 7 operations on my left knee, and I had letters from 2 orthopedic surgeons, 2 Navy commanders, saying that the deterioration of my knee is so bad that I need a knee replacement, a full tricompartmental arthrostomy. And the VA said, okay, that's all very nice, but we're not giving you any compensation for that. So I don't get anything. I got rated at 0% disability. So.
Oh, man.
Well, do the letters BS mean anything to you, Jay?
Yeah, right. Right.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, and I mean, I'm not trying to rag on the VA, because I'm, you know, I mean, they do a lot of good. There's no question about it.
And, right.
And they have helped a lot of military people. But their mentality, Jay, to me, is somewhat, and you know, kind of archaic in a way, because I have seen military men and women that were from my era. Some of the conditions just are deplorable to me, you know, based upon my philosophy that, you know, here we have men and women going and putting themselves in harm's way. Well, by God, then we ought to be, you know, when if they do get injured or something more catastrophic happens, shy of dying, you know, whatever we do, we need to take care of our troops, men and women. And, right. And it just aggravates the crap out of me that they sit there and try to jockey positions, trying to say, well, you know, it really doesn't qualify, you know, and it, I don't know. It just drives me crazy. Stuff like that just drives me crazy, Jay.
Yeah, no, it's difficult. And unless I have, you know, some sort of empirical data showing that, I obviously don't feel comfortable saying, well, the VA this or the VA that. I've been lucky in that my VA is affiliated with the University of California at San Diego and the medical school there. That hospital, all the doctors are UCSD physicians, so I'm getting about as good treatment as you can get anywhere.
You'd mentioned that too, when you know, regardless of who you are and what faith you are and what kind of mental attitude you have, that once you come back from Iraq or any war for that matter, you are a changed person. And I'm kind of curious, did you have to seek out any type of therapy when you came back? And if you did, what was it helpful?
Well, not right when I came back, I didn't, because I was like everyone else. So there's nothing wrong with me, and I'm a Marine. I can fix whatever's going on. But as I was writing the book and exploring Lava's mental health problems, that's when I said, well, maybe I'll take a look at myself and see what's going on, and realize I had these issues with anger and, you know, a lack of tolerance for some people. And I just said, well, you know, why not? Let's examine this a little more. And it was actually my publisher's idea to go to therapy, just on the basis of being able to write about it firsthand, so that when other veterans read the book, they'll understand what it's about. But it was very helpful. You know, it gives you somebody that, if you want, you can just vent, and they don't pass judgment, or at least not to your face, they don't. And it's somebody you can tell anything to, and you know that it's never going to get out to people who shouldn't hear it. So I think from that standpoint, it's very helpful. And, you know, like they say, it couldn't hurt. You know, better than a sharp stick in the eye.
Right. Yeah. All right, well, let me ask you a question. You know, obviously you've written two books, and of course From Baghdad to America is the sequel. What are the big primary differences between the two books, Jay?
Well, the first book is really, it's the story of being in Iraq and the Battle of Fallujah, and then Lava's journey, you know, the journey of bringing Lava to the United States. So that's book number one. And, you know, and it's written to have a happy ending and all that nonsense, so that people read it and they think, oh my God, what's happening? And then they realize that Lava's okay. And now the sequel is written. I guess my publisher wanted initially to have, you know, just a nice story about Lava since he's been back. But what it's turned into for me anyway is this story of self-realization, I guess, and this journey of finding myself back in the States and realizing that I am somewhat changed, and then being able to tell other veterans what that's all about and why they should go get help if they have even an inkling of an idea that there's a problem. And like I said, the time to do it is before the symptoms manifest themselves, because we don't want a bunch of young kids killing themselves or getting divorced or having substance abuse problems, and then getting bad conduct discharges and losing their benefits.
Right. I'm sure that a lot of the soldiers over in any scenario and war have to experience a lot on their mind. And one of the things that has always amazed me is how someone relaxes in a scenario like that. So where does a person like yourself or other soldiers go in Iraq or Afghanistan for R&R? And what would be some of the typical things that they would do to relax?
Well, you know, there is nowhere to go. So unless you're on a base somewhere that maybe has a computer center or a library, video game center, that kind of thing, there's really nowhere to go. It's pretty much just playing cards, dominoes, whatever you can do to pass it. If you know, if you have a Game Boy or something for the younger Marines, that's what they do. There's nowhere to go. Lava helped, I think, people relax when he was with us in Iraq. But otherwise, you know, there is really nothing. It's getting leave. If you're there for a year, you can get a couple weeks of leave during your tour and come back to the States. But otherwise, there's nowhere to go. There's really no outlet.
Well, that's a good question, John. Thanks for asking, because that brings to mind, you know, R&R back in Vietnam. I mean, a lot of people went to Bangkok or wherever, you know.
Right.
But you guys, you basically do your entire tour there, and then you have a chance. What can you go back home during that tour? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, sometimes people can go home during the tour.
Well, you said sometimes.
Yeah, well, not everybody gets to. If you're there for 7 months, you don't get to break it up and go home. But if you're there for 13 months, they let you come back. Yeah, you know, it's not like it was in Vietnam. There's no Thailand right next door to go to. It's, you know, there's nothing there. Where are you going to go?
Wow. And I'm not laughing to be laughing. It's just, you know, I don't know why that just didn't dawn on me that you guys don't have the same R&R capabilities that, you know, that we had. So,
no, it's really it's a pretty difficult thing. And, you know, you're gone from home for so long, and then you have to figure out, you know, they expect these young troops to not have issues. I mean, you know, what's a 20-year-old kid who's married going to be thinking about the whole time he's gone? You know, it's like,
exactly.
You know, who's Sally running with on the block while you're away? And it's
right.
It's a problem.
Oh, yeah. We had that problem. Yeah. Everybody's name was John that I met over in the NOM.
Right. You know, yeah. She's running with Jody back on the block. And it's a bad thing.
Right. Well, I'm curious, because that you talked about with there not being anything for them really to do unless they are playing a video game or doing something there at wherever they're stationed. Do you make the attempts now that you are back over here, you and Lava both, to try to stay in touch with the guys overseas?
Well, I've stayed in touch or tried to with guys I served with. So whether it's during their overseas tours or back here, you know, I do make the effort there. It's funny, you say that, and I just got an email last week from one of the soldiers that I served with, an Army Master Sergeant, and there are pictures of us together in my first book. And I'd sent Dan an email 2 years ago, and in May of 06, never heard from him. I mean, this was a guy who spent, I don't know how many years straight he spent in Iraq. You know, he came back a couple of times, but he was there for a few years, and I finally got an email from him the other day. It was amazing that after 2 years, he finally answered the email. But he's back in the States now himself and doing well. But, yeah, we try to stay in touch. But so many times people change units, and it gets difficult, you know, to track people down all the time unless you were, you know, pretty friendly with them to begin with.
Sure.
Right.
And by the way, I just want to mention that question came courtesy of one of our members at AboveTopSecret.com by the name of The Borg. So thank you, The Borg, for that question.
Well, if you have another one, John, there handy, why don't you go ahead and ask it?
All right.
Scanning through here.
Yeah, Galloping Hordes is another member that wanted to ask you a question. We had a lot of comments, by the way, for you, more so than we did questions. And I'll just briefly do the comments, and then we'll go into the question here for you, because we're running a little low on time here. Where's the Truth said that he was a Desert Storm vet, and even back then, the areas of Saudi Arabia and southern Iraq that they traveled in was always assured of seeing strays and injured animals of all types. He himself has 3 dogs which were all rescued. He holds a special place in his heart for any and all those who take in loving animals and share a good home and companionship. And so he also wants to you to know that he thanks you for your service to both your country, kin, and to Lava. Pure Evil 81 says he read about this in Reader's Digest. Thought it was a great story. Big hi-fi to you, Jay. Don't have any questions, but just wanted to let you know that he backs and respects everything you're doing. Irving the Explainer says that he got his book from his mom. She has Parkinson's disease and some spine and back problems. She couldn't get around much except for watching TV. And the one thing that put a big smile on her face was reading your book. And so he wanted to thank you for that. And now to the question. Galloping Horde says, I read your book after my younger brother, who also served in Iraq, asked me to. It was an excellent read, Jay. Thank you for sharing. Thanks also for your service. Do you think that it should be easier to allow returning military members who, like you, have found a piece of happiness in the middle of the war, be able to bring their pets home? And if so, how would you regulate it so that only healthy animals would be allowed to be brought back?
Yeah, thanks for all the comments. I appreciate your members' comments. That's terrific. As for that question, it would be really nice if it were easier. But I think if it were easier, you know, then you've got to figure out, okay, who's going to pay for it? Because it's expensive.
Right.
It gets to be very expensive to bring these animals back. You know, it's a couple thousand dollars each time. And a lot of these kids don't have the money. So then they have to raise the money. And then, you know, it doesn't always work out for people to have a pet. Not everybody should have a dog or a cat or whatever. So it's not always the best thing for the animal either. Gosh, should it be made easier, and how would you do it? I don't know how you would regulate it. You'd have to then take every animal to a military vet and get it examined and get it its shots. And, you know, really they're not equipped for that. The veterinarians are over there primarily to take care of the military working dogs that are deployed, and there are plenty of those. So, yeah, it would be nice. It's one of those things that would be a nice to have, but I just don't see it happening anytime soon.
Well, you know, there's before we get you to maybe comment on some of the things you got coming up, Jay, and one of the most interesting things that I found when I was doing some additional things that Jen had sent me is there's a really neat article that's by Colleen Mondor, who wrote something in October 2006 from Baghdad with Love and Marine, The War and a Dog Named Lava. And this whole article really, I think, really nails it on the head. But I want you to kind of wrap up before we talk about just some brief things that you have going on. Let's talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, I mean, obviously there was a buttload of soldiers in the Vietnam War that suffered from PTSD. And obviously there's also a buttload in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and conflicts that have come back with PTSD. You think there's a way, Jay, that we as military men that have gone through PTSD, is there a way that we can maybe show civilians somehow so they have a better understanding of what it's all about?
Well, you know, PTSD isn't unique to the military. Anybody can suffer from it. Some people are more predisposed than others. And it can happen for any number of reasons. You know, if you're in a bad car accident, or if you witness, you know, these kids who went to Columbine High School, you know, something like that can cause PTSD in just about anybody. So it's not unique to us. We don't hold the patent for it. But as far as showing civilians the effects, I think that, you know, hopefully enough people will read my book that the word will spread a little bit and people will have a better understanding of what happens to service members who come back with it. Unfortunately, there's been a lot more in the news lately about Marines and soldiers suffering PTSD and what's happened in their lives. You know, where we have at any given time about 150 to 200,000 homeless veterans from all wars. There are more Vietnam vets who are homeless than there were soldiers and Marines killed in and all service members killed during the Vietnam War.
Right.
So those statistics alone are frightening. and it's going to become a major societal issue if we don't get enough mental health professionals to help take care of all the veterans with PTSD. And so I think that rapidly society is going to become more aware of it, whether they want to or not.
I know we're almost out of time here, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask this question, because it was one of the topics that we discussed here at AboveTopSecret.com a few months back. I'm sure you probably have seen that YouTube video of a soldier tossing a puppy off of a foothill. I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, it's actually Marines, so I don't want to piss off the Army and say it was soldiers, but it was Marines, and they have been, one of the Marines has been kicked out of the Marine Corps. I don't know what the punishment is for the other Marine, the one who was videotaping that with his phone. You know, that's a horrible, horrible thing, and it may have been that these guys are suffering from PTSD themselves, and that's one of the ways in which it manifests, is this aberrant behavior, this abhorrent behavior that those Marines exhibited. You know, I don't know what's going to happen to them in the future. I guess if you believe in karma, he'll get theirs one day. But I know that the one Marine's been kicked out of the Marine Corps.
Well, you know, I tried to find a commonality of reason when the thread started, and that was that I don't care what it is, whether it's Marines, Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, or any civilian entity you can name me. I mean, there's always going to be one or two people that are going to, you know, kind of lose it, you know, but you shouldn't blame the entire group simply because of the actions of a couple of idiots. So, you know,
right. I don't think nobody who's rational, maybe some of the animal nuts blame the entire Marine Corps, and then they take it a step further and blame the entire Department of Defense for the behaviors of those two jackasses. But, you know, people that do that are just, they're kind of kooky themselves.
Right.
You know, you start looking at it, and I don't want to offend anybody, but I'm sure I'm going to, but animal people are a little nutty.
Well,
ones who are full-blown, like, over the top, you know, with all the dogs and cats living in their houses, they get a little kooky.
I know a rabbit that's pretty nutty.
Yeah, we got a few nutty rabbits around the place. What do you got going on, Jay? Any things that you got coming up in the next couple of weeks that you want to promote?
Just more media interviews. Anytime anybody wants to hire me for a speaking engagement, I'm more than happy to accommodate that through my speakers bureau and just some other signings and events. Mostly in San Diego, but then I'll be going to some of the bases up in Washington State and North Carolina and Virginia, and actually in Texas too. Be coming to Texas.
Well, good. Well, if you get to Dallas, you've got my email address, or Jennifer does, and just let me know, and I'd love to meet you personally if you hit the Dallas Metroplex. Dallas.
Yeah, I think I'm going to spend one night in Dallas. One of my buddies from OCS, I'm going to stay with him and his family, so I know I'll be there, and we'll try to hook it up I'm in town.
Good. We'll play a round of butt darts and see how good you are.
All righty. Sounds good.
All right, Jay, listen, we really appreciate the time, and obviously give our best to your new family, and especially give our love to Lava.
All righty.
And we really appreciate not only you spending time with us, but your service to our country, and you can't see it, but I'm giving you a salute from one soldier to another.
All right. Thanks very much. I appreciate being on the show with you.
All right, Jay. Take care, my friend.
All righty. You too.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.AboveTopSecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat.